Case number 065402, Earl M. Wiley, appellant versus Kenneth Y. Thompson, chairman of the Broadcasting Board of Governors. Mr. Alderman, the appellant, Ms. Sullivan, the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. I'd like to introduce you this morning, because you haven't had the pleasure of meeting, Verla Wiley. In 1977, Ms. Wiley was the first African-American female international broadcaster at the Voice of America. She's also a union representative, and in fact rose to vice president of the AFGE at the Voice of America. Over her years of service, she's represented dozens of employees in civil rights cases before the EEOC, and she's also upheld her own civil rights, and that's why we're here today. That's what got her on the radar screen of upper-level management in the Voice of America, protecting her own civil rights and those of other employees. Now, she retired in 2005, largely due to the stress that management placed on her. But she kept her union position, so she's still a vice president of the union. Only today, she has to be escorted every moment she's in the building, even to the toilets, which strikes me as unusual. Someone that's been in that building for the last 35 years has to be escorted to the restrooms. This case starts back in 1997 when Ms. Wiley sought, through her direct supervisor, Barry Maughan, a promotion to the GS-13, increased participation as a managing editor, and generally equality among the African-American women and the rest of the employees within the agency. Now, I heard the last counsel that was here say that he had the crux of his case. But this case has so many issues that there's not one particular crux. We've got the non-promotion. We've got the district court's failure to consider the retaliatory non-promotion. You've got the managing editor position, and then you've got the claim that wasn't necessarily considered. That's the reduction in airtime. Then you've got the retaliatory harassment claim that didn't get full consideration. So there are several cruxes in this particular case, and we can start going down the line talking about those discrete actions, and then I'll be obviously happy to take your questions, or you can just jump in with the questions.
Well, let's start with the non-promotion claim.
Thank you.
And correct me if I'm wrong, was apparently seeking what's called an accretion of duties promotion, correct?
To even give it a name at the Voice of America, and in particular in English to Africa, I think would be the first mistake. Barry Maughan and Steve Lucas. Barry Maughan is the chief of English to Africa. Steve Lucas was the Africa division director. And their testimony, as reflected in the joint appendix, was that Mr. Maughan initiated promotions and then his management completed it. Steve Lucas says Barry would come to me and we would do promotions under advisement, right? Then Mr. Maughan, when he's testifying about Joe DiCapua's promotion to GS-13, which occurred just a year before Ms. Wiley had asked, when Mr. Maughan describes that promotion, he says that was a backroom deal between him and personnel. So this notion that one had to actually go through a formalized process called an accretion of duties promotion is bogus. And when the government cites to this fact, they've got a statement from one of the personnel specialists that says the only way to get a non-competitive promotion is to sit through a desk audit. And they've got a citation to the record. And we picked apart that citation in the reply brief. There's absolutely no factual basis for the assertion that an employee had to sit through a desk audit.
I think the question that Judge Brown is asking is, whatever you call it, there has to be a basis for a promotion. Yeah, the desk audit is highly questionable, but whether you call it an accretion of duties or anything else, one assumes that if you get a promotion, it's based on something. And so the question in this record is, what is it that was put in to justify the or fulfill the prima facie case to show that the duties of the existing job at 12 had changed so that they were at a promotable level? Whatever you call it, accretion of duties, whatever.
Well,
they did show that with respect to DiCaprio, that there were some enhanced duties, but whatever. Even if DiCaprio didn't exist, it wouldn't matter, because there would have to be some basis for a person in any institution to claim I should go from something to something else.
And in this particular case, Your Honor, it would be raising Ms. Wiley to parity with the majority of the international radio broadcasters in English to Africa. The majority of them, the vast majority, were GS-13s. Now, Ms. Wiley was one of the central players in that office. She was the host. She did stories. She was a senior member of that team. But she was an African-American female, and as a result, she was a GS-12. And she was making complaints about unequal treatment. And so when she approached Barry Mon to get her 13, like Joe DiCapua had approached Barry Mon the year before, Barry Mon says, well, you have to have supervisory duties to get a 13. And yet, in his deposition, he admits that Joe DiCapua didn't have supervisory duties before he was a 13. And now, we've got Barry Mon's statement that supervisory duties, that means being a managing editor and being a senior editor. But the agency has now said, you can't do either until you're a GS-13. So, Judge Edwards, you raise a great question. What does it take to be a GS-13 in this office? And apparently what it takes is being a white male who doesn't complain about civil rights abuses.
Is there anything in the record that says that the desk audit was not necessary? I mean, is there anyone who testified to say, no, you don't need to have the desk audit?
If there is a crux in this case, Your Honor,
Answer the question. Let's start off with yes or no.
No, Your Honor.
Well,
no.
DiCaprio didn't have a desk audit.
DiCaprio didn't have a desk audit.
So that's the answer.
We've got it by inference. The answer is yes. There's a lot of evidence that other people didn't go through desk audits. But there's no one sitting there and saying, no, you didn't have to do that.
You never asked that question of anyone, did you? I mean, nowhere in the depositions, you didn't ask anyone, you know, did you not, you know, was the desk audit not required?
And Judge Griffith, I'm not trying to pass the buck here. Yeah. I came onto this case after the motion for summary judgment had been filed. So I wasn't there during discovery, but I've obviously reviewed it. And there were questions. There were questions to Barry Mon and Joe DiCaprio. And Ms. Wiley's first attorney asked Barry Mon, what did it take to get Joe DiCaprio his promotion? And Barry Mon says, I brought it up to Steve Lucas. I initiated it. Steve Lucas didn't care for it. Joe DiCaprio, when he was asked, what did it take, what did they consider when they made your promotion, he says, I do more than everybody. No mention at all of a desk audit. And that's the easy answer. I sat through a desk audit, and a personnelist said that my duties were those of a GS-13. That's the easy answer if you went through a desk audit, for both the employee and the manager. But in this case...
Now, you said that, maybe hyperbolically, everybody was at a 13 except the appellant, and she asked for hers and she didn't get it. Now, is there anything to confirm two things? One, that everybody else was in the unit was in fact at 13, and is there anything to indicate that the duties of the appellant were the same as everybody else to whom you were referring?
Let me correct one thing. If I said everybody else, that was a mistake. The vast majority of the GS-13s.
Is there anything to show that the vast majority were 13s and that
yes,
their duties were comparable or less than what the appellant did?
Yes, Your Honor. If you look in the joint appendix, and that would be, I'm not sure the page number of the joint appendix, but we did catalog the list of GS-13s in that office. And so that's in the record. Now, but this is another point that I think bears making in this particular case. The district court got hung up on each of the points that we've made before the court. The district court gets hung up on the prima facie case. But in this case, the government has provided its non-discriminatory justifications. And according to George v. Levitt, according to Tenick, Stella v. Mineta, you fast forward. Once the government has proffered its non-discriminatory justification, you fast forward to the ultimate issue, which is why everybody's here. Did they or did they not intentionally discriminate? Now you get to whether or not the justification is true or not, and not, Your Honor, Judge Edwards, whether or not she can undergo the rigorous test of whether every relevant aspect of the employment situation was identical to her colleagues. The government has given its reason. Now let's see if it's right. And what you find in this particular case is that it's not right. The government in the non-promotion case, their excuse is she didn't ask for a desk audit. Well, that's not what happened at all. Barry Mon said no. She then complained about it. She then asked again, and she asked other people, and they said, well, if you really want it, then you can try a desk audit. But if you're white, or if you're male, or if you don't complain about discrimination, Barry Mon says, I'll see what I can do for you. No desk audit. Desk audit is for the African-American female complainers. That's how we deal with them.
My reading of this record is that, in fact, the person who was promoted, this Capua, his name, did undergo a desk audit.
Your Honor, if I haven't seen that, and I've read this record a lot, and I think this goes into another of the district court's errors, and that's misapplying the standard on summary judgment. On numerous occasions in this case, the district court gave the government, the moving party, the benefit of those inferences. And Judge Brown, I think what you may be referring to is a sentence in an affidavit wherein the personnel specialist says the words, Mr. DiCapua was promoted by way of an accretion of duties promotion. It says absolutely nothing more. It doesn't say he went through a desk audit to get his accretion of duties promotion. It says only that Mr. DiCapua was given an accretion of duties promotion. That's it. So the inference that the court drew was that he went through a desk audit. But that inference doesn't go to the government. That inference goes to the plaintiff, the employee. And this misapplication of the summary for the standard for summary judgment, it occurs there, but it also occurs in the retroactive taking of leave case. And in that particular case, and I know we're jumping around, but these are the themes. In the retroactive taking of leave case, the court, despite the record evidence from the director of personnel, from the deputy general counsel, from the employee labor relations specialist and the director of the Office of Civil Rights, they all say that this October 2001 policy, that, by the way, addresses exactly Ms. Wiley's situation what happens if you are a plaintiff in a multi-plaintiff lawsuit and you want to attend the depositions of your co-plaintiffs. All of a sudden, this clarified policy addresses the exact question that Ms. Wiley asked when that question had never been raised before. You have these numerous high level, the highest level, employees in this office. Director of Personnel, Deputy General Counsel, Employee Labor Relations Chief, and the Office of Civil Rights Director. They all say, this is a new policy. The Director of Personnel and the Employee Labor Relations Chief, they're asking themselves, have we negotiated with this with the union? It's clear that this is a new policy. By that testimony, by that record evidence, and the district court draws the inference in the other direction, that this wasn't a new policy, despite this testimony.
Counsel, I should warn you, you have used up your rebuttal time, but we'll give you some additional time.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. The district court correctly determined that the appellant had failed to demonstrate that she was qualified for a promotion to a GS-13. The unrebutted record reflects that there are only two ways to obtain a non-competitive promotion, and that is either by an impact promotion that hasn't been given since 1993, and it was given to a Ms. Hunt, an African-American female, and by what they call an accretion of duties promotion. And an accretion of duties promotion, according to the declaration of the personnel specialist, Ms. Grace, is by evaluating whether or not the duties of the position that you're in have increased such that they warrant a promotion. Now, whether you call it a work audit, a desk audit, it requires some evaluation by the department, by the Office of Personnel, and there is nothing in this record, and I may add the burden is on the plaintiff, not the defendant, that that Mr. DiCaprio, one, his duties had not increased and that they were substantially different than Ms. Wiley's, and indeed that this evaluation that he was promoted because of these accretion of duties.
There isn't anything to indicate DiCaprio went through a desk audit. The testimony is it was a back behind, no. It was a deal, someone like DiCaprio.
No,
so.
I think that's...
the problem I'm having with on the promotion thing especially is, this of course dismissing on a prima facie case. Prima facie case is nothing.
But
I don't know how you can say you can't, they haven't made out a prima facie case, especially when you're talking about desk audits and supervisory duties, none of which, there's nothing to indicate. That's your alleged response. And there isn't anything to support that. That's your proffer. If your proffer is inaccurate, then you don't get past the prima facie case.
Well, I think the burden is that she's got to, under existing law, demonstrate that she is qualified for a promotion, and she has done nothing of the sort. What she has said is simply this, when asked directly why she thinks she's been...
That's your case we're talking about.
I understand, right. But you still have to show some qualification.
Edge, that's all.
And she then also has to demonstrate that the failure of her to be promoted was under circumstances that would permit an inference of discrimination. And absent her showing
others were promoted
that she was...
Others, most others were promoted and I wasn't, and there was no requirement of a desk.
But how were they... But how?
So there's an inference. I'm talking about the prima facie case. There's an inference. Now, you can fight it out beyond that, but the district court says no. It's just It's done. At the prima facie case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Tell me again. I'm missing it.
That the undisputed evidence is clear that her duties remained the same throughout that period. There is no indication in this record that the others who were promoted, and we're only talking about DeCapita in this relative time frame, increased. She hasn't demonstrated that she is performing at a level that would warrant a promotion. That
you've gone past the prima facie case now.
Well, then I'll take it any way I can get it. We've clearly articulated.
I'm looking at what the district court did. The district court said there's no prima facie case that's been made out here, and there just seems like there's all kinds of disputed issues of what accretion of duty really means, whether a desk order is required, whether you really had to have any change in job duties as opposed to time, and some kind of subtle value change as opposed to actual change in duties. None of that's clear here. That's the kind of thing you'd respond to. If a plaintiff comes in and says, everybody else has been moved, and I didn't, and I'm in the protected class, that makes out the prima facie case.
Yes.
That's a prima facie case.
But everybody else, many of these people that counsel was referring to already had their 13s. They came in that way, or they applied. I direct your attention to the declaration of Ms. Grace, and I believe that's 239. And she goes through the promotions during that period. And all of them either, 63. Ted Roberts was an accretion of duties promotion in 1993, an African-American male. A subsequent one was a competitive promotion. Rashida Hassan, an African-American female, but that was a competitive promotion. Appellant Ms. Wiley never applied. There was no vacant position, Your Honor. The prima facie case requires some showing beyond I'm an African-American female and someone else got promoted.
What do you mean she didn't apply? Did you say she didn't apply?
Well, I was comparing her to another African-American employee that got a promotion to a GS-13. She actually had applied for a position. And that's on 230.
What about the managing editor?
The managing editor position?
The government responds, you didn't express an interest. The record just doesn't support that.
Well, she did. When Mon came in, but she had never volunteered previously to shadow a managing editor. She never volunteered to do any of those things that would lead you to the competency to become a managing editor. Her sole function since 1990 was the back half of that program, which was pre-recorded. There's no indication that she was writing news stories, news analysis, working with stringers, planning and preparation, preparing live broadcasts. And not only that, her own testimony says that she was working 40% of her time as a vice president of the union, and as a and also that to be a managing editor, you had to be there most of the day. If you're gone 40% of your time, you cannot engage in those and be a managing editor for a two-hour live broadcast. And I, in response to Judge Edwards' questioning. I think the record is absolutely clear that the duties that Mr. DiCapo were doing were substantially different and far beyond the duties that appellant has described. That he was writing original scripts, he wrote manuals, he, in fact, according to Ms. Depew, the senior editor, he wrote more articles not only for the African Bureau but for the News Bureau than anyone that she had ever seen.
Can we talk about this question of being granted administrative leave for depositions?
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel says that this policy was changed in response to her query.
The record does not reflect that, and I think the excellent opinion by Judge Hogan analyzes it as well. At the time that appellant asked whether or not she could have official leave to attend these depositions, there was, in effect, the labor agreement between the management and the union that provided those circumstances under which leave would be permitted. In addition, there was the MOA, as they or MAO, as they call it, the operating procedures of the agency that provided the circumstances under which you could take leave. And in addition, there was 5 USC, I think it's 6332, and the actual site is in the brief, Your Honor, that were in effect. And before her supervisor inquired of personnel, responded, advised her that the then existing regulations did not authorize her to take annual leave. Now, clear, the record is suggests that many managers and others were unclear of the differences between leave permitted and the policies that occur at the administrative level and before the EEOC, as opposed to what is authorized in district court. That policy, and I think we may be quibbling about words, clearly it was a new memorandum that summarized the prior policies. It added no new additional policies. The entitlement was to official leave was exactly the same on October 5 as it was on February 14th when the plaintiff requested the leave. Now, to the extent that there was now an additional government memorandum summarizing the existing law, sure, there was an additional, but it didn't change any rights to, that she had.
One of the issues on appeal is the claim for retaliatory harassment.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I'm a little confused. Voice of America had noticed that retaliation was at issue, right? I mean, it's pretty clear that from the amended complaint that she was making a retaliation claim amongst the other claims. Why was that subject to a motion to strike? I didn't understand that.
Well, I did not make the tactical decision as to how one would address that. But I do think that there was, if you read the amended complaint, granted she has what she did, or how they structured it, and I think created some confusion. And that is you have something like 60 allegations of things that are alleged to be improper. Then you have count one. You know, this is all one through six are discriminatory. 1 through 16, 60 are retaliatory, and the other, they all constitute harassment. And that was perceived to be a, I lost my train of thought, forgive me. We knew she was claiming retaliation, but it was, and I think properly so, the way she structured her complaint and through the depositions was that she was being harassed because of her sex and race, not because of the retaliation. And
So what could she have done to have avoided that motion to strike? She's got an amended complaint, she takes discovery, and then you all move for summary judgment, and in response to that, she says, you know, remember, one of these claims out here is retaliatory harassment, and that doesn't survive. I don't understand why that...
But that complaint, reading that complaint, Your Honor, does not, when I read it, raise a retaliatory harassment claim.
Suppose we disagree.
Okay, we disagree.
Suppose we disagree.
Then I said, "What I think the district court was correct in suggesting that, regardless, the actions that are alleged under this this claim, one he already addressed and found that they were neither retaliatory or that they rose to the level that they were pervasive and severe enough to support a."
Basing it on a legal theory that in order to support that claim, you have to be able to have a hostile, prove a hostile work environment. I suppose that's wrong as a matter of law. Have we ever said that? I don't think we've ever said it.
Well, in order to...
That's the premise of the district court's rule.
Well, I'd submit, Your Honor, that retaliatory harassment in and of itself to raise a claim, either you have a discrete act of retaliation, or the retaliation is so severe that it becomes harassment and by definition becomes, to be actionable, has to create a hostile work environment claim. Your Honor, I see my time is up. If there are no questions, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
You can have a minute.
I thought I reserved 5 minutes
for
rebuttal.
Well, you did, but you kept talking.
We chewed it right up, huh?
And you talk slowly, too.
We better speed
That's
it up then, Your Honor.
Not ours.
Okay. Your Honor, you asked about what gets you the a promotion, and the fact is that Barry Mond says that supervisory duties get you the promotion. We know that's not true. That explanation in itself gives rise to the inference of discrimination. He gave a reason that's not true. Again, going to the managing editor situation, Ms. Wiley was never given a choice between her union duties and acting as a managing editor. The inference, again, was given to the government. In fact, Barry Mond says, I'm not going to ask her that question. Are you kidding me? Basically. So she was never given the opportunity to undertake those managing editor duties. They assumed that she wouldn't do it. And then please, please, please read Barry Mond's memo to Steve Lucas, where he says a clear message has to be sent to Ms. Wiley and the others. A clear message has to be sent? To Ms. Wiley and the others? And then talking about managing editor training, he says, training for Ms. Wiley cannot be managerial in nature unless she decides to be a team player. It's right there. This isn't even this is a direct evidence case. With regard to the leave, despite all those written materials that Ms. Sullivan just talked to you about, nothing applied to this particular case. There's no specific thing that applied in those rules, and these highly placed officials said that the policy was liberal. What does that mean? That means that they applied the same policy that applied to the administrative cases to court cases. They said, okay, you got an EEOC case? We don't care where it is. You get leave to attend depositions. That's the liberal policy that they were talking about. And then with regard to the retaliatory harassment claim, if they didn't think it was clear, Rule 8, move for a clarification of the complaint. I came on as new counsel. I read that complaint. I said, there's obviously a retaliatory harassment case. I think that this panel did the same thing. So we thank you very much for your
time. What's the difference between a retaliatory harassment case and a hostile work environment?
Your Honor, I would greatly appreciate the opportunity to give a supplemental brief on that issue.
No, I mean, that's in the helpful case. You either have an answer for it or not. I mean, that's a premise in your argument. What's your answer?
The premise of our argument is that the court failed to consider all the aspects that went into that.
No, the premise in your argument is that there's a difference. So what's the difference?
The difference, if there's one, it's under Burlington, and it's the materially adverse standard that applies to retaliation claims. There's a different standard.
You decided the retaliation claim. So is there some third category, retaliatory harassment? And if so, what is that?
Your Honor, I think that retaliatory harassment is a hostile work environment. You have to show that it changes the conditions.
Right. It's the same thing. This court said, in effect, if you don't have hostile work environment and proof of it, you lose this other category.
I think that it's correct that you have to demonstrate a hostile environment for your retaliatory harassment, and I think we have done so.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.